Very good morning, and thank you for joining us here at the UN office at Geneva for this press briefing. Today, the 27th of September, we have a very packed agenda. We have the situation as it unfolds in Lebanon. We have speakers from Beirut actually joining us, as well as from the Syrian-Lebanese border. We have the situation in Sudan. We have an expert from UN Women joining us, as well as our colleague Ravina from Human Rights, who will speak to Haiti afterwards, and also a colleague from UNHCR who will address the penalization of asylum seekers. So very packed agenda. We'll take the first three speakers on Lebanon first, then we'll take your questions and move on to the second subject thereafter. So we turn now immediately to Mr. Imran Riza. I'm very pleased to have Mr. Riza join us. He's a humanitarian coordinator in Lebanon, who again is joining us from Beirut. So over to you, Imran.
Thank you very much. As I think you've all seen, the recent escalations in Lebanon are nothing short of catastrophic. For nearly a year, what the future holds. Many have expressed concerns about experiencing a situation similar to Gaza. And for the past year, we have consistently urged all parties to de-escalate to prevent that from happening. Unfortunately, in just a few days earlier this week, hundreds of thousands feel that they are now facing a comparable fate. The surge in violence has extended to previously unaffected areas, leading to widespread destruction of homes and infrastructure across the country. In less than a week, at least 700 lives have been lost, thousands have been injured, and nearly 120,000 people have been displaced within mere hours, with these numbers continuing to rise as we speak today. The crisis has also affected us directly, the UN, with the tragic loss of two UNHCR colleagues and one of their sons. The situation, as I said before, is catastrophic. My colleague from UNHCR will speak more about that. We are witnessing the deadliest period in Lebanon in a generation, and many express their fear that this is just the beginning. The UN and its partners are closely coordinating with the Lebanese government to support the response efforts. This includes aligning aid distribution, conducting joint assessments, and identifying urgent needs for affected populations. Lebanon's health system is already overwhelmed. The events of last week, including the explosions of communication devices, have nearly depleted health supplies. With the recent escalations and hospitals reaching capacity, the system is struggling with limited resources to meet the growing demands. However, together with our partners, we are delivering food, mattresses, hygiene kits, and emergency medical supplies to those affected by displacement. Nearly 500 shelters are accommodating around 80,000 displaced individuals right now, including 300 schools that are being used that have been repurposed. So that impacts the education of about 100,000 students, pupils. Critical funding gaps persist in various areas, including shelter repair, site management, food stocks, fuel, and coordination. We are now assessing the amount of funding required to address the increasing number of displaced people and the rising humanitarian needs. We've been working diligently to ensure safe access for those seeking humanitarian assistance and for our teams delivering aid. Expanding efforts to secure unimpeded access for humanitarian actors remains essentially, particularly for those still in affected areas and collective shelters. We will continue to emphasize this tirelessly. Civilians must be protected. Civilian infrastructure should not be targeted. The safety and security of all UN personnel and assets must be guaranteed. International law must be upheld. Looking ahead, the path forward is fraught with uncertainty. The priority now must be to secure an immediate ceasefire to halt further civilian suffering and destruction. The humanitarian community urges all countries to leverage their influence to facilitate an immediate de-escalation. In fact, what we've been talking about for the last 11 months. However, even if hostilities cease, the aftermath of the violence will require a massive coordinated humanitarian response to address the widespread displacement, rebuild critical infrastructure and restore essential services. The health, education, and economic systems are already stretched to their limits. You all know what Lebanon has gone through over the last 4 or 5 years. So there will be, beyond immediate relief, what we need right now are parties to lay down their arms, prioritize diplomacy, and recommit to the full implementation of UN Security Council Resolution 1701. The region cannot endure further bloodshed. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Riza. And I should note that Mr. Riza's marks were shared with you previously by Jens here. Now I throw to Ivo Freysen, who is UNHCR's representative in Lebanon, who also joins us from Beirut. Ivo, over to you. We have a connection with Ivo. Okay, perhaps we're having a little difficulty connecting with, I saw you on the call just a moment ago. Maybe in this case, what we can do is skip over and go to Gonzalo Vargas Llosa, who is UNHCR's representative in Syria, who's actually joining us from the Syria-Lebanon border. Gonzalo, let's try connecting with you.
Yes. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we hear you, Gonzalo. Please, go ahead.
Great. Okay. Good morning. So, yes, as you mentioned, I'm here at the main border point between Lebanon and Syria, about an hour away from Damascus by car. Colleagues and I have been here and at other three main border points between Lebanon and Syria for the past 72 hours since the latest crisis started, and thousands of Syrians and Lebanese started to cross, fleeing the violence in Lebanon. I will just make three points. First, in terms of who's leading the response to the crisis, and here I want to be absolutely clear. This is being led by the government of Syria and the people of Syria, thanks to their generosity and to their open doors policy, not only, of course, to their own citizens, to the Syrians who are crossing back, but perhaps symbolically even more important, to the Lebanese, to whom they refer as their brothers and sisters. Now, operationally, who is leading the response at the national level is the Syrian Arab Red Crescent, who are doing an amazing job and who have been here really 24/7 since the first arrivals started. In terms of the international response, of course, given that we're dealing with two different caseloads in terms of our arrivals, both Syrian refugees in Lebanon who are coming back home or crossing back home, but also Lebanese refugees who are crossing into Syria. UNHCR is leading the response with the support, with the help, and in very close coordination with UN agencies and NGOs, and we're also very grateful for the support that the resident coordinator and humanitarian coordinator has been providing us. Now, in terms of what we have been witnessing at the border over this last 72 hours, I mean, large numbers of people returning. The estimate is that this figure is now well over 30,000. About 75-80% of those Syrians and the other 20% or so Lebanese. Now, these, of course, are people who are fleeing bombs and who are crossing into a country that has been suffering from its own crisis and violence for 13 years now. And a country, of course, that is also in economic collapse. And I think that this just illustrates the kind of extremely difficult choices both Syrians and Lebanese are having to make at the moment. We are seeing many women and children, but also some men crossing. The estimate is that at least 50% of those crossings are children and adolescents. They are exhausted, they are scared, and they are in need. But I think there's also a palpable sense of relief in spite of the uncertainties about what will happen over the coming days and weeks as they cross the border into Syria. Now, most side of all, we have seen quite a few injured arriving. People who've been injured not only through the very arduous journey on the way here, but also injured as a direct result of the bombings in Lebanon. Yesterday, for example, we were here also, and we saw a woman crossing with two dead children from Lebanon who were to be buried here in Syria. Now, what is it that they need? I think there are two parts here. One, of course, is the absolute immediate needs that need to be addressed at the border: the provision of water, of medical services by the Ministry of Health of the government of Syria, I should say, very much the provision of food, blankets, etc. I think that for the time being, those immediate needs are largely being addressed, also because we were fortunate enough to have large quantities of relief supplies in our warehouses when this latest crisis started. Now we'll have to see what happens over the next few days. But of course, if the situation continues to be the same, those stocks will need to be replenished. But the second, I think, perhaps a little bit more complex part of the response, of course, will be to assist people when they return to their communities of destination, because of course they are not going to locations very close to the border. They are going to Damascus, they are going to Homs, they are going Tartus. I mean, they are even going as far as Raqqa on the northeastern side. Now here, fortunately, for the Syrian arrivals, UNHCR and its partners already have substantive structures inside the country, which have been used now for some time to support Syrian returnees, particularly like the 114 community centers that we have all over Syria, and which provide a whole range of services like psychosocial support, child and gender based protection, and specific programs for the elderly and disabled, shelter repair, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the point is that those structures that so far have been used to support Syrian returnees, Syrians crossing from the region back into Syria, now they are being expanded so that they can also support and assist the Lebanese refugees. And final point, still on the Lebanese and specific in terms of the accommodation, fortunately, most of the Lebanese who are arriving, we are seeing that they are able to stay with relatives, with friends, or take care of their own accommodation. But the government of Syria is establishing a number of collective centers around the country so that they can also accommodate those destitute Lebanese who may not have a place to stay. Thank you.
Thanks to you, Gonzalo. I think now we have Ivo connected, and his audio is fine. So Ivo, we're going to go back to you. Joins us from Beirut. Ivo.
Thank you. Apologies for the glitch. I think Imran was very elaborate and comprehensive, so I just add a few points. First of all, let's stress that we have been unfortunately preparing and partly expecting the current scenario for 1 year. So we should not be totally surprised. But when I say preparing, it's planning and also doing part of the practical work. But these plans have been impeded by a lack of funding. So the call for funding rapidly now so that we can still step up is extremely important. We thank all friends and partners for the condolences received in the wake of the horrendous tragic killing of two members of the UNHCR Lebanon family. We're trying to derive positive energy out of this and new resolve to pursue and discharge our mandate. But we, of course, couple it with a reinvigorated call for respect directed to parties to the conflict, evolving around respect for international humanitarian law, the safeguarding of civilians, the non-targeting of civilians and aid workers. We saw it in Gaza, and the same messages apply very much in the Lebanon context. Question we often get is, are people still moving in rich numbers? Less than in the beginning of this week, but people are still, first of all, moving out of areas where they are in danger. And when people arrive to other areas, many still struggle to find a place to go to. That is partly a capacity challenge, a capacity problem, but for many also a financial challenge. It's simply expensive to rent an apartment, for example, in the center of the country. So the more resource-constrained Lebanese, and that is an increasingly large group due to Lebanese ongoing, previously developed economic challenges, a lot struggle, of course, much more than, for example, in 2006 when a similar situation happened. Country is in a much more fragile state, and many Lebanese are much more vulnerable and exposed pre this specific crisis, let alone during the current situation. Relative positive news is that, again, compared to 2006, the humanitarian community is larger, stronger, has more resources. But these resources are still primarily actually for our ongoing programming, not enough funded. So there is not enough of a backbone to additionally quickly ramp up and address new needs. And that is now increasingly, of course, coupled also with logistical and access challenges. And then, of course, we keep our fingers crossed that we're not going to see that become even further complicated with, for example, the airport closing. UNHCR has been very much part of the cross-population response in a variety of sectors. I will not dwell on all the details, but again, important to underscore that, of course, we have refugees in the heart of our mandate, but the response is cross-border, cross-population to the greatest possible extent. And for now, we have provided over 140,000 core relief items and cash assistance to 60,000 people. Majority of our beneficiaries are actually of these kind of practical assistance measures are Lebanese. A key concern is that, as you all know, presumably Lebanon has been hosting large numbers of refugees and others for over a decade, 1.5 million Syrian refugees. And that has become an increasingly challenging topic and challenge in general for the country. And that is now playing a role in this context where we see renewed and enhanced and strengthened calls for accelerated return of the Syrians to Syria, which is now depicted as much safer than Lebanon, for example, in many social media posts that we track. We also see other challenges where it is not easy for Lebanese to have access to shelter, as mentioned. So we are engaged in active discussions with the authorities to ensure that the response is, of course, context sensitive, that we should not ignore, but also in line with humanitarian principles, impartiality, non-discrimination, and so on and so forth. Because refugees often have preceding previous vulnerabilities that we need to take into account. And at the end of the day, they are also on the move. And having them exposed and not provided with adequate form of assistance is not something that we would like to see further take place and become more serious in the context of Lebanon. Of course, we wholeheartedly join the overarching plea for a solution, perhaps initially a temporary solution, but subsequently a structural political solution, a renewed plea for donors to step up in this context, so that we can address better than we currently do, more comprehensively than we currently do, emergency assistance needs, with also indeed a look at a phase possible that hopefully will emerge after the emergency phase in terms of recovery. Should that not happen, should assistance stay or not pick up substantially, then we will be faced with a situation of increased complexity, more deeply rooted needs, which will actually be more difficult and also more costly to address. So the time to respond adequately and comprehensively and generously is indeed very much now. Thank you.
Thanks to you, Ivo, and of course to Imran and Gonzalo. So we'll turn now to our colleagues here in Geneva for questions. We have a question starting off with Agnès from Agence France-Presse. Agnès.
Yes, thank you. This would be a question to the UN refugees and to IOM. I know they are listening as well. So two specific questions concerning Syria. How many refugees, and not only refugees, people are you expecting to cross into Syria? Do you have a figure? And the same question to IOM concerning the displaced people, or maybe OCHA, I don't know, displaced people inside Lebanon. Do you have any contingency figure plans on that? Thank you.
Thanks, and yes, maybe Gonzalo on the first question, numbers expected to move into Syria, if you can take that, please.
Yes, this is a very difficult question to answer because, of course, it's going to depend very much on the situation in Lebanon. I mean, our hope is that there are no more crossings. But what is also clear is that already before, but of course particularly over the past 72 hours, we've been working very closely with the government, but also with partners at all the border points where we have seen crossings already, to beef up and strengthen the capacity for reception and processing. So should more crossings happen, I think we're in a better position now than we were 72 hours to make that reception more smooth. I think that I will add a point here that I didn't mention before, and I think it's the fact that the government has instituted smoother, faster procedures for Lebanese to arrive. You know, Lebanese to cross into Syria, normally one, they need a passport or an identity, a fixed identity, a set identity document. For the past 72 hours, Lebanese have been able to enter the country as long as they have any type of paper that shows their name. Now, this is something very exceptional. Not only that, but when they arrive, and let's say for those who are carrying passports or IDs, they are not getting a stamp that says that they have a fixed time by which they need to leave Syria. So for the time being, it's an open-ended authorization to stay. Thank you.
Thanks to you, Gonzalo. I think maybe Imran is very well placed to maybe respond to the question about projections for displaced inside Lebanon. I know that you point to the question IOM. We do have somebody from IOM online. And of course, Ivo may be able to chime in as well. But let's start off with Imran on the question about projections of displaced inside Lebanon.
Sure. Okay, up till last Monday, this past Monday, we had about 110,000 displaced, and IOM has of course been working with the government and tracking this. From Monday onwards, in the last 5 days, we've had 118,000 displaced that we've recorded so far. So it's double the figure now. It's over 200,000 that we have displaced.
Okay, thank you very much, Imran. Ivo, if you have something to add, please just let us know. I think your mic. Yep, go ahead.
Just to add that as Gonzalo says, it's all unfortunately closely correlated and linked to conflict dynamics. And we increasingly know that some areas are virtually empty now. Some people still there who can really not move. Should insecurity become more intense and widespread, also these people leave, and other areas will see larger departures. So our contingency planning documents and processes definitely cater to, unfortunately, also these scenarios where you talk several hundreds of thousands of people on the move.
Thank you very much for adding that note. I know that, and yes, you pointed the question to IOM. We do have Kennedy online. I don't know if Kennedy, if you have anything to add, just throw up your hand. Otherwise, if you could maybe connect with Agnes afterwards with any specific points from IOM. Okay, so let's maybe move ahead. Okay, Jamie Keaton from Associated Press has a question.
Thank you, Rolando. My question is for Mr. Vargas Llosa also. I think a lot of people are going to be a bit somewhat surprised that people will be leaving Lebanon to go to Syria, which is a country that, of course, has faced, 13 years of conflict. So my question really is just the safety of a move into Syria. For example, not only the conflict within Syria that's existed, but also military action in the current conflict, maybe Israeli strikes in Syria. For example, I understand that there may have been a strike in Kfir Yabus, not too far from the border crossing. So how safe is that crossing given the hostilities that have befuddled and confounded Syria for many years, both a long time and recently? Thanks.
Thanks, Jamie. Gonzalo?
Thank you very much. I mean, I think that I mentioned at the beginning the fact that, both Syrians and Lebanese, I mean, they are crossing from a country at war to one that has faced a crisis conflict for 13 years. Now, we can imagine, or maybe we can't imagine, you and I, just what an incredible, difficult choice to make that is. Now, the fact is that in the past 72 hours, well over 30,000 people have made that choice, that extremely difficult choice. And we will have to see over the next few days how many more do so. That is not the ideal situation either for refugees to return back home or for refugees to leave a war and cross an international border seeking safety. So in that sense, this situation is extremely atypical. Now, on your specific question about the safety of the border posts, yes, that is a very good question. And the answer to that question, of course, is only with those who are doing the bombings, not with us. What I can say is that fortunately, over the past 72 hours, the four border points where there are UNHCR staff there, but much more importantly, where people are crossing into Syria so far, they are safe and they have been opened 24 hours a day. And we, of course, we would make a plea, not only for the bombings in general, to stop, but also, of course, to avoid bombing people who are trying to flee. Thank you.
Thank you for that comprehensive answer, sir. If I could just get you to maybe give us a flavor about the actual situation where you are. In other words, you mentioned the bombings. I mean, it's a relatively small region, and you know, you may hear explosions far off in the distance, but Kfar Yabous is not very far from where you are, I don't think. So how close are these explosions that you're hearing? Do you have concern that the bombings are could possibly be close to the areas where the refugees are fleeing?
Well, look, all I can say is that I hope that is not the case. But of course, what we hope is that there's no bombings anywhere. So you know, it's very difficult to answer that question. All we can do really is make a plea for the bombings to stop. That's all we can do at this stage. Thank you.
Thank you, Gonzalo. Okay, let's move to the next questions. We still have a few not in the room, but we will turn online now. John Zarakostas, our correspondent from The Lancet, and Franz von Gatt. John.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for the briefing. I've got a couple of questions concerning some of the information just mentioned on the number of displaced. UNICEF are reporting out of Beirut that it's 211,000 displaced, including 74,000 children. And Save the Children are reporting 400,000 people displaced, including 140,000 children. So I'm wondering, perhaps Jens, what's the latest from the UN coordination on the displaced and especially the children? And since Margaret is online, she can bring us up to speed on the number of killed and injured and people waiting for emergency operations still in Lebanese hospitals. Thank you.
I think Imran actually was starting addressed some of this, but maybe we'll go back to Imran to clarify and maybe elaborate on some of those figures he recently announced. So Imran, back to you.
Okay, thanks. As you can imagine, I think from Monday we've had such a level of escalation. Let me just put it in context in a sense. In 2006, in the 34th day war that happened in 2006, you had twice as many people killed as you had in one day on Monday this week. So the level of displacement, the level of trauma, the level of panic has been huge. What we have been able to do, and it's primarily IOM that's working through this displacement tracking mechanism together with the governmental authorities, is get the figures that I told you earlier, which is 110,000 that were earlier displaced, and now an additional 118,000 to today as the official figures that we're using. Now, does that mean it's comprehensive? Because many people will have been displaced for second or third times. So give us a little bit of time on coming back with exact numbers on this. It's the same situation with the hospitals. The health sector is completely overrun at this time. We had done a great deal of preparedness work, and luckily we had managed to get trauma kits and the like in, and try to have them distributed also throughout the country, because now the displacement is happening not just in the south. For the first 11 months, it was mainly the south, it was mainly the Bekaa, and within particular parameters there. But now it's throughout the country. And, you know, here in Beirut, you have thousands of people that have arrived and are wondering where they go next. Many people, I mean, anecdotally, you're running into people that are saying, what's the way to Tripoli? How do we get to there? So the displacement is spreading, and there is a huge effort to make sure that we get the right numbers. You were mentioning the number of children affected. That is key. The other element is that right now we're going to have a real crisis in terms of education, because it's basically public schools that are being used as shelters at this time. So we have to A, make sure that we can manage these properly, but also try to find alternatives and try to make sure that the kids that are being displaced right now are also getting education.
Thank you so much. Thank you. We do have Margaret online from WHO. If you wanted to add something on that question from John. Margaret, go ahead.
Yes, certainly. John, the latest figures I have are from yesterday, and they're the figures we have from the Lebanese Health Ministry. So you may want to get more recent numbers. The numbers I have are awful, that 738 people are known to have died as of yesterday, and there were 5,908 injuries. You ask who's waiting for surgery. The hospitals, just as my colleague said, are overwhelmed. So essentially anybody injured in the last few days is waiting for help. And also remember the hospitals were very, very busy with very specific injuries from the pager blasts and the walkie-talkie blasts, because they had a lot of injuries to their hands and their eyes, which required very specialist treatment. And there still are a large number of people. We've got, according to my numbers, 777 injured remaining in hospitals, and 152 of those are critical cases. That means they're not leaving the hospital for quite some time. And so every day of bombing and blasts fills up beds that can't be unfilled. You don't just operate on somebody and move them out. We also have 37 health facilities closed due to these events. 11 in the south, two in the Bekaa Valley, and 20 in Nabatea and Marioun. I think those were your main questions, but also it is important to understand that, just as my colleague said, we did do a lot of preparatory work. We did place trained most of the health workers in most of the hospitals for mass casualty and mass casualty event. But you know, in our planning scenarios, we didn't have anything like the numbers that have actually been affected. It was way beyond anything that normal planning, even for a horrific event like this, would have expected. Over.
Thank you very much, Morgan. Of course, you'll appreciate colleagues at the situation is very fluid. And of course, Jens and colleagues will certainly update you on the latest figures as this progresses, sadly. We have a couple of questions left before we move to the next subject. So we'll go now to Catherine Fionkin of France 24, and then Lisa Schlander, VOA, starting with Catherine.
Thank you, Rolando. I'd like to come back on the figures. Could you kindly repeat clearly the figures, meaning what is the global number of refugees who arrived in Syria until now? I have also a question on refugees that arrived in Cyprus, because many people left Beirut for Cyprus. Do you have figures on that one too? And also the financial needs. What are the financial needs the people, particularly for the people arriving in Syria? Thank you.
Okay, so I think we'll have to go back to Gonzalo for the first question, and then we'll take it from there. Gonzalo.
The figures are being, you understand this is a very fluid situation, and so the figures are being refined. I spoke about well over 30,000. We know that it's more than 30,000. Hopefully by the end of the day, we will know exactly how much more than 30,000. But it's at the very minimum 30,000 who have crossed. That is both Syrians and Lebanese. And I also said that about 80% of those well over 30,000 are Syrians, and about 20% are Lebanese. And I also said that of those who have arrived, about 50% or just over 50% are children and adolescents. And I also said that out of the well over 30,000, it is women and children, but also in smaller numbers, men. That is all, I think, as precise as we can be at this moment. Thank you.
Thanks, Consuelo. And I think if I understood correctly, Catherine, your question was about financial needs inside Syria, or was this for the broader arena? Because maybe, Consuelo, you could add something on the needs.
Syria. Okay. Syria. And, Gonzalo, thank you for the figure. It's 30,000, so meaning 30.
If you can clarify that, Consuelo.
The expression I am using, and quite deliberately, is well over 30,000, because we know it's not 30,000. We know it's more. But we're trying to refine the figures with our partners. You understand, very fluid situation, people coming in from several different border points. It's difficult to give you a scientific figure this precise moment, but I can tell you that it is well over 30,000, and hopefully by this evening we will have a more precise figure.
Thank you very much. If we can stay with you just for a second, Gonzalo, I think the question also pertained to the financial needs. I know you touched upon this already, the financial needs for Syria. If you had anything that you could add to elaborate.
Yes, sorry, I didn't catch that part of the figure. I mean, as I think that the situation is a bit the same in Lebanon. Here, I mean, the international actors and the local actors working on the humanitarian front have, been facing a situation of serious underfunding already 3 days ago, before this crisis, this latest crisis started 3 days ago. So I said at the beginning that fortunately we have some stocks in the warehouse that are able to address the immediate needs at the border right now. But you know, that is only a very small part of the equation. There are the huge needs that existed here already 3 days ago. This is a country where we have millions of internally displaced persons. So now this latest crisis is just adding to that. So our hope is really that this will be a wake-up call, and those appeals that we have all been making for additional funds for the past months now will finally produce some results. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I know, Catherine, you also had a question about those who may have fled to Cyprus. I'm not sure, maybe Ivo, if you had any information on that.
Actually, that has not really featured in exchanges in recent days. And I just checked with our protection team, and we don't have updates on this. And there are, for the moment, no indications that something new is happening. But we need to be clear and precise what we're talking about. Attempts by primarily Syrian refugees, but also other nationalities, including sometimes very destitute Lebanese, to reach Syria by boat. That is not a new phenomenon. That has been ongoing, although of late perhaps less than previously. But then we also have, of course, other departures. Lebanese, with the financial means, have been making arrangements, different choices in terms of where to be or where to send part of the family for most of the past year. And that was accelerated, of course, in recent days. And we all know that Cyprus is a location where a lot of Lebanese then go to, or other places with which they have close ties, certain countries in Europe, for example, to await what is happening and to see if a moment comes for them to return. You see all kinds of different movements of people and places where they can go to, and different means being used depending essentially on the socioeconomic status.
Okay, thank you very much, Ivo. I think we'll just take one last question to exhaust this item. This is Lisa Schlein of Voice of America online.
Thank you, Rolando. Good morning. My question is for Gonzalo. Earlier, you seemed to indicate that the Syrian government was welcoming to the Lebanese refugees and that they extended their stay in the country for as long as necessary. I'm wondering whether the government is extending the same kind of generosity to returning Syrian Syrians from Lebanon, or whether they are in greater danger having come back to this country, which remains in serious conflict. Thank you. And what can be taken to perhaps protect them in a way that is not necessary, perhaps, for the Lebanese? Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. Gonzalo?
Yeah, I think I missed, the connection is not very good. I think I got maybe the gist of your question, Lisa, but maybe not the full full extent. Look, Lisa, you know, I'm happy to have a conversation with you separately on the broader issue of the situation of Syrians who are returning from the region to Syria. I don't think we can make justice to that complex issue, you know, in a couple of minutes, which is what we have. But what I would say is that in the past 72 hours, you know, we've had dozens of colleagues from UNHCR present at the four border points where Syrians are crossing back. And we have not seen any situations which would be a cause of major concern for us in relation to those Syrians crossing back. And I did add that among the Syrians crossing back are also young men. So far, what we have seen here is not a cause for alarm. Now, what we do in Syria, and we've been doing this before the past 72 hours, is working very closely with the government on the issue of safety of Syrian returnees, whether they are coming back from Lebanon, whether they're coming back from Turkey, whether they're coming back from Jordan. This is a key issue. So I understand the importance of your question. My staff, and I have over 400 staff in Syria, much of their time is dedicated now to monitoring the situation of Syrians returning to Syria, including, of course, of men and of persons of a certain profile. So that work of monitoring returns, but also of working with the government, because of course it's the responsibility of the government to ensure the security of their own citizens, that work will continue and intensify. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gonzalo, and to Imran and Ivo as well for joining us here at the briefing. And of course, you're most welcome to join us at any point in time. Stay well, stay safe, and thank you once again. We're going to move to the situation in Sudan now, and I thank Ms. Hodan Adu, the Regional Director for East and Southern Africa for UN Women. I thank you very much for your patience and for joining us here, Ms. Adu, who is joining us from South Sudan, I believe. So over to you, Ms. Adu.
Thank you so much. I hope you can hear me.
Perfectly well. Thanks again. Yep, go ahead.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for giving us an opportunity to share with you the findings of a report, which we call a gender alert, that is published today by UN Women, which gives a spotlight, a much needed spotlight to the impact. The findings of this study are based on the work that we're doing inside Sudan, looking also at the data from our United Nations and humanitarian partners, as well as consultations an analysis from the vast number of women's led organizations that we work with inside Sudan. This gender alert found a distinct and disproportionate impact of the escalating conflict in Sudan on women and girls, which has led to a twofold increase in sexual violence, finding that sexual violence is being used as a weapon of war throughout this conflict. The ongoing violent conflict has exacerbated the risks faced by women and girls in Sudan, with rising reports of conflict-related sexual violence, sexual exploitation, and abuse, particularly in the states of Khartoum, Al-Jazira, the Darfurs, and Kordofan states. Nearly 5.8 million women and girls who are internally displaced are particularly vulnerable, with many cases of sexual violence going unreported due to fear of stigma, retribution, and the lack of adequate support. The high levels of sexual violence and exploitation need to end, and appropriate justice mechanisms and support service has to be instituted with appropriate justice mechanisms and support for all of the victims. Sudan is facing, as you all know, the worst levels of acute food insecurity ever recorded in the country. The UN Women Gender Alert report shows that women and girls are also eating least and last, with 64% of female-headed households experiencing food insecurity in over 10 states. Given the high levels of food insecurity and the looming threat of famine, the negative consequences for displaced women and children will intensify unless urgent measures are implemented. Women and girls also continue to be disproportionately impacted by the lack of safe, easily accessible, and affordable water, sanitation, and hygiene, with more than 80% of the internally displaced women unable to secure clean water. Access to healthcare services is also a huge challenge, with over 1.6 million women and girls of reproductive age not having adequate services. Among them, we've seen the reports from our sister agencies that over 160,000 are pregnant women, and an estimated 54,000 childbirths are expected in the next 3 months. It is really terrifying reality for women in Sudan. And as we've seen and discussed with a 26-year-old woman we've talked to when compiling this report, she has told us that she was displaced from Omdurman to Atbara and has shared her harrowing experience of fleeing violence while 4 months pregnant, facing constant threats of murder, rape, and looting. Now, a refugee in her own country, she experiences the severe psychological toll the conflict has taken and calls for urgent psychological support, protection for herself, her family, her community, and an end to the war. Women and girls in Sudan are facing unimaginable challenges, yet we found that their strength and resilience continue to inspire all of us. Now more than ever, the international community must rally together to support the women and children in Sudan, ensuring that they have the resources and protection they need to survive and rebuild their lives. UN Women is working in three of the areas, that three states. We have physical presence among the other UN agencies in Port Sudan. We also, of course, have a presence in Blue Nile State. Our other offices, due to the conflict, had to be closed, but we're working closely with the women's organizations that have been providing and continue to provide direct services to the displaced and to those who are surviving from sexual violence. The work that we're doing is supporting community-based initiatives in partnership with women-led organizations aimed at mentoring women and building their resilience. Together with our sister UN agencies and humanitarian partners, we urge the international community to prioritize the protection and the empowerment of Sudanese women and girls, including through the increase of funding for local-led organizations that have received less than 2% of the funding from the Sudan Humanitarian Fund in 2023. The atrocities against women, children, the elderly, and the larger civilian community of Sudan are simply unacceptable. UN Women stands in full solidarity together with our UN system and support for the brave and strong women and girls of Sudan, supporting them in their call for an immediate cessation of hostilities. It is imperative that there is protection of civilians, full humanitarian access, support, and pursuit of an inclusive path to peace that includes women's full participation in the process. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
Thank you so much, Ms. Adu. We do have a question for you from Lisa Schlein of Voice of America. Over to you, Lisa.
Thank you. I'm speaking up. I hope you can hear me better than than Gonzalez apparently did last time. I'd like to know who are the major perpetrators. I had heard, perhaps you confirm this, that the rapid support forces somehow were more implicated in this war weaponry of raping women and children and so forth. If you could speak a bit more about that. And also, what sort of psychological support, if any, is there in getting these people, the women who need help, and how do you manage to break through the stigmatization that they experience from their communities? Perhaps you or also Margaret, hi Margaret, WHO, could speak a bit more about the health problems which actually are arising from women and girls being raped. Hi, Margaret. sorry, it's not funny. Being raped, sexually abused, and whether this is also, whether there are many women who are actually having children that unfortunately come out of this situation. Thank you.
Thanks, Lisa. Over to you, Ms. Adu.
Yeah, thank you so much for those questions, and glad to see that we have colleagues from WHO that could perhaps address the issues related to health. But what we're looking at is various data and analysis that we've gathered through the our UN system, but also through our own partners and so forth. As you all know, the recent investigations or that has taken place in regards to the Human Rights Council's report on the independent international fact-finding mission that they've had really does show a very high level. In fact, in our data is about 100% times the rape and the sexual violence that women and girls are experiencing, as well as humanitarian actors, including women-led humanitarian actors, the nationals in particular. And of course, that report does target the two perpetrators of the violence, the conflict where it's taking place. And we are calling for a cessation of hostilities. We're calling for protection for all women and girls, in particular, the retributions that they need to address. We're calling for accountability and the provision of justice to all of the victims, including a comprehensive approach to transitional justice based on inclusive dialogue and consultations, very much led by and supported by the women's organizations who are on the ground. The high level of sexual violence and exploitation is used as a weapon of war. It's preventing women from accessing the much needed resources, whether it's on access to healthcare, to, of course, education and food and water. And it's really preventing women from even having the psychosocial support because of the chaotic nature of this conflict that all of actors who are engaged in this violent conflict have to be, accountable to providing safety and security for all of the women and girls. Of course, you know, in as we've seen in many conflicts and as well as in Sudan, rape, sexual violence has been used as a weapon of war. It is a way of breaking communities. It is a way of tarnishing social fabric of a community by targeting the most vulnerable. It is a despicable and human right violation and humanitarian violation that we need to hold anyone accountable, and we need to ensure that all of the actors of the conflict, including their armed militias, are held accountable. But most importantly, this war has to end, and we need to find a solution of peace, but also a retribution to the victims that have suffered for more than the war has dragged on for more than 15 months. So we need to really end this. The situation is grave. The level of psychosocial support that is needed, especially for the survivors, and as I had told, mentioned the 26-year-old who was displaced from Orduman to Atbara, and all of the other women that we have interviewed in this report states the need for psychosocial trauma, whether they are inside the country or they've fled to neighboring countries. This is a huge, huge task that we need to do to ensure that we have a comprehensive response that looks at the totality in terms of the impact this horrendous conflict has had on the lives of women and children, many of them seeing their loved ones killed in front of their eyes, having seen brutal sexual violence against the children, against women, as a way of, as I said, putting more trauma, more fear on communities, more repression and abuse and sexual exploitation for even accessing basic human needs for water, for food, and shelter, and so forth. So we need to really, as this report gives a spotlight to the situation in Sudan, which has been really been forgotten. The brave humanitarian workers, our UN staff who are there in the country, risking their lives on a daily basis to provide the support and the much needed support needs to be topped up. We need to ensure that there's adequate funding and resources for the humanitarian crisis, but we need to ensure that there is peace that comes with justice, that includes the voices, the participation of women, so that their lives, their realities of this conflict takes into account the type of peace and intervention. But we need to hold all actors accountable to this really desperate situation that we're seeing. The famine glooming is really, really, it's a terrible situation that we're in. And as we've seen reports coming out from OCHA, the data that they have shared as part of the UN system gives us really shocking numbers of huge numbers of population of people, particularly in North Darfur, who are facing dire situations in the IDP sites, and the acute food insecurity that is there. It's really detrimental to the survival of many of the women and girls in the communities that are in a desperate situation. Let me end there, but I hope I had responded to those questions, but I'm sure there's other colleagues who can provide additional support.
Thank you. You have indeed answered various horrific angles to this crisis. Among them is the health situation. Maybe on that note, we'll now go to Margaret. I think Lisa had a question pointed to you. Margaret.
Yes, indeed. And thank you, Lisa. And thank you also to my colleague for raising this forgotten crisis. The access to healthcare continues to be severely constrained due to the insecurity, the attacks on healthcare, the shortage of medicines and medical supplies, shortage of health personnel, and no cash to cover the health facilities' operational costs. In the conflict hotspots, 70 to 80% of hospitals are non-functional. And so people are dying simply from a lack of access to basic and essential healthcare and medication. You asked specifically about women and indeed critical services, including maternal and healthcare, maternal and child healthcare, the management of severe acute malnutrition, which, as you know, is just rising every day. And the treatment of patients with chronic conditions have been discontinued in many areas at a time when they need it the most. Across Sudan, women are dying from pregnancy or childbirth related complications, whether or not those pregnancies are a result of gender-based violence, whatever, women are not getting the standard care that saves your life and saves the life of your child during childbirth or before childbirth. Also, childhood vaccinations have been disrupted, as has disease surveillance and vector control. And coupled with access issues and the natural disasters, it's created the perfect conditions for the spread of disease outbreaks. And indeed, again, as I said, surveillance is poor, but we have reports of cholera, measles, malaria, dengue, meningitis being received from several states as of 16 September 24. I do have some numbers, 5,491 suspected cases of measles and 120 associated deaths reported from 11 states. And remember, this is in the context of very, very poor surveillance. So the real situation will be a lot worse. But we have had also 9,484 suspected cases of dengue fever with 75 associated deaths reported from 12 states and 1.8 million clinically identified malaria cases and 178 deaths from 15 states. And again, as I mentioned, meningitis is on the rise, 155 cases of meningitis, 19 deaths from 10 states. I'll stop there, but you know, the situation is just horrendous. No access, no means of providing the basic care that is a human right.
Absolutely. Thank you so very much, Margaret. Indeed, it is a horrific situation. And in terms of the figures, we'll make sure to capture that in our summary, colleagues. And of course, if you need clarification, do reach out to colleagues speaking here. John, did you have a question for Ms. Adu?
My question is to Margaret. She was reading out all these latest depressing figures from Sudan. I was wondering, Margaret, if you also have figures from the field on the number of pregnant women and children that have been dying, especially in South Sudan. There was a very moving report by MSF from the field on that issue.
John, I don't have specific numbers on that. I will ask my colleagues in Sudan if they've got, if they can provide those. Given our surveillance and the limitations, I doubt we'll have accurate figures, but we may have estimates.
Okay, that would be helpful. Thank you, Margaret. And thank you again, Ms. Adu, very much for joining us here and for your patience. Of course, the aim is to make sure this is not forgotten, this crisis. So your interventions here are really supremely important in that regard. And thanks for sharing the report with our colleagues here in Geneva. Okay, now I turn to my colleague Ravina from the Office of the High Commission for Human Rights, who has an update on the insecurity situation in Haiti and the situation there overall. Ravina.
Thanks, Rolando. Another very difficult, very dire situation, and another very neglected situation as well, I'm afraid. Tackling insecurity in Haiti, where hundreds have been killed, injured, or displaced as a result of gang violence, has to be an utmost priority. Latest figures documented by the UN Human Rights Office indicate that at least 3,661 people have been killed since January this year in Haiti, maintaining the high levels of violence seen in 2023. No more lives should be lost to this senseless criminality. We welcome recent positive steps, such as the establishment of a transitional presidential council, the new transitional government, and the deployment of the first contingents of the multinational security support mission. It is clear, however, that the mission needs adequate and sufficient equipment and personnel to counter the criminal gangs effectively and sustainably, and to stop these gangs from spreading further and wreaking havoc on people's lives. Our report details extremely serious patterns of human rights violations and abuses taking place across the capital of Port-au-Prince and in the Artibonite department, as well as in the southern part of the West department, which until recently had been largely unaffected by the violence. The number of victims of sexual violence, including rape, also increased in the first half of the year. According to the report, gangs have continued to use sexual violence to punish, spread fear, and to subjugate populations. During the reporting period from January to June this year, at least 860 people were also killed and 393 injured during police operations and patrols across Port-au-Prince, including at least 36 children, in what could constitute use of unnecessary and disproportionate force. On the impact on children, the gangs have also recruited large numbers of children into their ranks. In Artibonite, which is the country's agricultural heartland, increasing gang violence and extortion have forced farmers to abandon more than 3,000 hectares of land, further imperiling Haiti's food production. And this at a time when an estimated 1.6 million people in the country face emergency-level acute food insecurity. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights urges the Haitian authorities to take robust steps to strengthen the police and other state institutions crippled by endemic corruption, including the judiciary, if the rule of law is to be restored and those responsible for violations and abuses held to account. We also call on the authorities to redouble efforts to protect children from gangs, to tackle gender and sexual violence, and to protect internally displaced people. We urge the international community to comprehensively implement the targeted arms embargo, the travel ban, and asset freeze imposed by the UN Security Council to stem gang violence in Haiti.
Thank you very much, Ravina. And maybe just to add that in consulting some of our latest figures, we note that nearly half of the Haitian population, that is 5.5 million people, are in need of humanitarian aid, and many of them are women and children. So this is indeed a very dire situation. So thank you very much for your briefing. Do we have questions for Ravina? Yes, Agnes from AFP.
Yes, thank you. Yesterday, the Haitian leader said that is looking for transforming or turning the MAS, the multinational policing operation, into a peacekeeping operation. I was wondering if you think that would be a better way to protect the civilian population facing all these human rights violations. Thank you.
Thanks, Agnes. Yes, indeed, I'm aware of those reports. What our immediate concern is that any force that is there, so currently the multinational security support mission, needs to be adequately and sufficiently resourced with the equipment that they need to be able to do their jobs properly, as well as the numbers, in sheer numbers of people. What we are currently seeing is that they are very inadequately funded and inadequately resourced. So that should be the priority.
Thank you very much. Yes, please, sir. Third row.
Oui, alors, pourquoi ça traîne autant le déploiement de la masse? Oui. Quand est-ce que ça devrait être prêt? Quand est-ce qu'ils vont commencer à vraiment faire quelque chose?
Thank you for that question. Indeed, this is why the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights is urging the international community to make this an utmost priority. Unfortunately, with the proliferation of crises and conflicts in the world, sometimes the situation in Haiti is neglected. But as I said, more than 3,600 people have been killed so far this year, and this maintains the high levels of killings and violence, extortion, kidnapping, sexual violence that has been carried out over many years now in Haiti, exacerbated also by the humanitarian situation, by gangs that are blocking off key arteries that prevent resources, essential resources, food, water, fuel, from reaching the people who need to reach it. We are raising the alarm. Illicit flows of arms are continuing to go into Haiti, in spite of Security Council resolutions calling for these to be stemmed. Humanitarian appeals are chronically underfunded as well. So we are raising the alarm here and saying that the situation in Haiti needs to be an urgent priority ahead of the UN Security Council meeting next week on this.
Yeah, indeed. My goodness. Just to remind you, indeed, that the Security Council is taking this up, and we expect a decision maybe before the but next week at this point. And of course, it's imperative that the Haitian National Police be provided with the resources they need, including equipment, donor coordination, training provided to the HNP is also of paramount importance. So these are the issues that are being discussed in New York. Yeah, Jamie, go ahead.
Hi, Ravina. Shouldn't it just be a matter of course that the Human Rights Office would support the idea of a peacekeeping mission? I mean, from a human rights perspective, you know, one would think that, I mean, I know it's not your decision whether or not to deploy a PKO, but from a sort of basic level, wouldn't you support that? And could you also comment, if I understand correctly, President Ruto, while in New York, mentioned that he's planning on augmenting the number of Kenyan forces that are going to be sent to Haiti. So could you please address each of those, please? Thanks.
Thanks, Jamie. No, as you pointed out, it wouldn't be our decision whether a peacekeeping mission is deployed or not. That would be a matter for the Security Council. What is crucial for us is that any force that is deployed is adequately resourced, adequately funded. They have both sufficient and adequate equipment to respond to the crisis that's happening, bearing in mind the geographic realities of Haiti, bearing in mind the strongholds where the gangs have them. And of course, also what is crucial is that the international community takes action to stem the weapons flow into Haiti. That is continuing, and that needs to be stemmed immediately. I have forgotten your second question. Ah, yes, of course. No, we would support any augmentation of the MSS, of the Multinational Security Force. Absolutely. We would encourage further resourcing of this force.
Thank you very much. We do have a question for you, Ravina, from Lisa. Go ahead.
Hi, Ravina. I don't know how to qualify my question, maybe naive or whatever it is, but it appears that the government is toothless and not in the position to be able to protect the people of Haiti. I was wondering, what is the ultimate goal of the gangs? Is it to take over the government? I'm kind of wondering whether there is a chief bandit who is in charge of most of these gangs. And can they just keep on raping, pillaging, extorting, whatever it is, horrible things they do? And this keeps on without any stop? It could conceivably one of them take over the government. That's a question.
What we understand, Lisa, I mean, of course, the intent of these gangs, you will have to ask the gangs, but what we understand based on their modus operandi and what they've been doing is they're trying to maximize territorial gain as well as financial gain. So through all sorts of illicit methods of getting money, extortion from people, charging people, charging shopkeepers so that they will not attack them, so that their shops will be protected. Charging people for crossing checkpoints, kidnapping people and charging high ransoms, illicit financial flows, illicit arms flows, and taking control of territory. This is what's happening, and they're doing everything that they can to maintain this control, including raping women, raping children, killing people that they perceive of opposing them, killing people that they perceive of being affiliated with rival gangs, of being affiliated with the police, wanton violence. And as I said, they're also controlling access roads so that people cannot access food, water, electricity, fuel. Hospitals are having to operate using generators as opposed to electricity to carry out essential functions. The designated expert of the High Commissioner was in Haiti recently, William O'Neill, and I spoke to him, and he said he spoke to a girl who hadn't eaten in 2 days. He spoke to a woman who has diabetes but has no access to insulin. These are basic things. You shouldn't have to die of diabetes simply because you don't have access to insulin. But this is what's going on in Haiti right now. And this is why, in spite of the proliferation of crises around the world, we need to raise the alarm. We need to draw the attention back to Haiti.
Absolutely. Lisa, is that a follow-up question? Go ahead.
Yes, a quick follow-up, Ravina. Who is furnishing these gangs with the arms? How can that be stopped? They are not a country, so you can't put sanctions on them. But yeah, what can be done? And who is giving them the arms? Thank you.
So the weapons and ammunition have continued to flow into the country, primarily from the United States, but also from the Dominican Republic and Jamaica.
Thanks very much. And of course, this is indeed unprecedented levels of lawlessness and brutality, which we're hearing about in Haiti. So thank you very much. Okay, we do have one last question, maybe from Agnes from AFP. Oh, sorry, we have another question afterwards. So AFP, then you, sir.
Yes, this is just a quick follow-up to the answer you just gave to Lisa on the weapons coming from United States and the other two countries. Could you specify if it's you are talking about the country, about state companies, or about private companies? Thank you.
Thanks for the question, Agnes. I am going to refer you to the report as well. Now, if you go to paragraphs 47 and 48 of the report that you've received, there's more detail on this. In fact, there's further detail in a UNODC report, which has really, you know, gotten into substantial detail about where these arms are coming from and how they're coming in, what needs to be done to stem this. So, for example, the UNODC says that firearms and ammunitions have continued to enter Haiti through poorly monitored airspaces, unpatrolled coastlines, and porous borders. And, of course, the gangs exploit those gaps, and they obtain high-caliber weapons, drones, boats, and a seemingly endless supply of bullets. Similarly, drug trafficking has also continued unabated, often using the country's many clandestine airstrips.
Thank you very much, sir.
Oui, alors les États-Unis et le Canada ont bloqué les comptes, enlevé les visas d'une multitude de personnalités haïtiennes. Quel est l'effet que ça a eu jusqu'à maintenant et quel effet vous espérez en obtenir?
Sorry about that. Some countries have already been taking measures, and of course there have already been Security Council resolutions on this. What is still lacking is implementation. So we are saying that there need to continue to be urgent and stricter measures taken to prevent the direct or illicit supply, sale, diversion, or transfer to Haiti of weapons, but also to keep updating the list of individuals and entities who are subject to the Security Council sanctions regime for engaging in directly or indirectly or supporting criminal activities contrary to international human rights law. So the implementation of these travel bans, asset freezes, and other sanctions on targeted individuals needs to be strengthened.
Thank you so very much, Ravina. Further questions on Haiti? No, that's not the case. So thank you once again, as always, for joining us here, Ravina. And I thank Elizabeth Tan of UNHCR for her patience and for being here with us. As you know, Elizabeth is no stranger to you. She is UN Refugee Agency's Director of International Protection, who is going to address the situation of asylum seekers. Elizabeth.
Thank you. So this week, UNHCR has issued new legal guidance on the way states should treat asylum seekers who arrive at their borders in an irregular manner. Article 31 of the Refugee Convention states that states are prohibited from penalizing asylum seekers and refugees merely because they've entered a country irregularly. So UNHCR's guidance is explaining what that article of the convention means. That article is there because many people flee life-threatening situations and they have no other choice but to take irregular manners of travel, and they often don't have the opportunity to obtain a travel document or a visa or retrieve it before they fled their country. So at the same time, the convention does not provide a blanket protection from penalization for breaching immigration rules. It's only when three conditions are there that protection from penalization applies. Those three conditions are directness of travel, promptness of declaring oneself as an asylum seeker to the authorities, and showing good cause for having contravened the immigration rules. So that means that, for example, the guidance explains that refugees and asylum seekers must present themselves to the authorities without delay, and they must show a valid reason why, for example, they've entered without a visa. If these three requirements are met, then refugees and asylum seekers should not be detained for entering irregularly, including where detention is used for the purposes of deterrence. UNHCR's guidelines are also, they address the situation of penalization linked to smuggling. It makes clear that refugees cannot be penalized if they are suspected or found to have been involved in organizing, assisting, or facilitating their own or others' illegal entry or stay, as long as they were the ones being smuggled or they took these actions to secure their own lives, the lives of their family members, or others' entry and for humanitarian reasons. Whilst the concept of non-penalization is one of the core principles of refugee law, it's often misunderstood or deliberately disregarded in practice by some states. And some states are imposing penalties on refugees and asylum seekers simply for the reason of having illegally entered the country or illegally being present in the country. So this guidance is released at a time of increasing legal and practical barriers to accessing asylum. And the guidance is aiming to promote consistency in the application of international law. It explains the Article 31 of the Refugee Convention, and it serves as a timely reminder that seeking asylum is not a criminal act. It's rather a life-saving measure and a fundamental human rights. At the same time as coming out with this legal advice, UNHCR is also urging states to respect and ensure not only compliance with refugee law, but also to work together to advocate for other alternatives, for safer journeys, for providing access to asylum in safer ways and through legal routes. So that's what I wanted to share with you this morning. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth. Do we have questions? Yes, we'll start maybe Jamie, then Taha. Go ahead. Okay, go ahead, Taha.
Thank you for giving us this information. I have a question about Sudanese refugees in Egypt. We have noticed that you aren't concerned about these refugees in Egypt. These refugees are suffering from discrimination and deportation from Egypt. As well, in Olala, Sudanese refugees in Olala forest, also, they facing the same situation. Could you give us any information about this bad situation? Thank you.
Yes. So indeed, there are more than a million refugees from Sudan in Egypt, and many people fled during the recent crisis. And at the beginning, people were allowed to cross the border. There was, in fact, a very large influx. Subsequently, the government of Egypt put in place visa restrictions. So. The fact of having crossed the border without having that visa and using a smuggler, which is happening quite regularly right now, should not be penalized by the government of Egypt. That is what the convention says. That is what is explained in the guidance that UNHCR is putting out this week. So we know that governments are struggling with the numbers of asylum seekers, but this is what and putting in place visa restrictions is not something that we're saying is not fine. Governments should be able to regulate immigration and border crossings. That is their sovereign right and indeed necessary for many reasons. However, when people circumvent those immigration and border controls and they're claiming asylum, they should not be penalized for doing that. So people should still be able to access the asylum procedures. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth. Jamie?
Thank you for your presentation. You mentioned that there's this new legal guidance. Is that just a regular matter of course, or are you thinking about specific instances where countries have flaunted their obligations under the Refugee Convention? I'm particularly thinking about the United States, which has recently enacted some new measures to curb the flow of people across the border from Mexico. Is that specifically what you have in mind, and is this a message directly to Washington that it needs to abide by its commitments?
This is the first time that we're issuing guidance on that particular article of the convention. It's not directed at the U.S. It's directed at all states. This is an obligation for all states, and we are concerned. There are indeed countries, including the U.S., that are trying to manage their situation at their southern border, and we're working very closely with the U.S. government on the methodologies that they're using to restrict access to the country, to somehow manage that situation. So when new legal restrictions come into place, we do, of course, analyze that in with regard to the in this case Article 31. But there are many other obligations on states in terms of granting access to territorial asylum and giving access to the asylum procedures. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have further questions for Ms. Tan? No, I don't see that's the case. So thank you very much for joining us. Thank you for your patience. Thank you, colleagues. I still have a couple of announcements before we wrap up. And just as usual, just to keep you on track with the proceedings here in Geneva at the UN, we have a couple of committees underway. We have the Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights 76th session, which is concluding this afternoon after having reviewed reports on Iceland, Poland, Honduras, Kyrgyzstan, Albania, Cyprus, and Malawi. And the Committee on Enforced Disappearances is also meeting, and on this it actually concludes next week, next Friday, a week from today, the 4th of October. But on Monday, there'll be a meeting with states and NGOs and national human rights institutions and intergovernmental organizations. That's on Monday, the Committee on Enforced Disappearances. Human Rights Council, also well underway. It's now at its halfway mark, the 57th session of the Human Rights Council. Today, the Council heard an address from the President of the Marshall Islands, Ms. Hilda Hein. That was at 10 o'clock this morning. You can take a look at her statement, which addressed climate change, nuclear testing in the South Pacific. There was interactive dialogue, which I think should be concluded by now, with the Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. The UN Assistant Secretary General for Human Rights, Ms. Ilse Brandt-Karas, is also presenting a report on reprisals, a very important subject, reprisals against those who cooperate with the UN entities. That is a report being presented today. And lastly, this afternoon, the outcome of various reports from the Universal Periodic Review, the subsidiary body of the Council, will be addressed. North Macedonia, Vietnam, Afghanistan, and Cyprus. And maybe just to shift direction to the other side of the pond, the Security Council today is discussing this afternoon the situation in the Middle East, which has been, of course, dominating our agenda here as well. And on that same subject, I wanted to announce the press conference this coming Monday, the 30th of September at 5 p.m. In this room, Philip Lazzarini, who is, as you know, the Commissioner General of the UN Relief Works Agency, UNRWA, will be here. So 5 p.m., Philip Lazzarini in this room. We sent out the announcement already. I should just mention, as a side note, the Secretary General delivered remarks at a high-level ministerial meeting in support of UNRWA earlier this week. Actually, it was yesterday. We share those remarks with you, so do take a look at those statement, that statement from the SG. That's all I have. Do you have questions for me? A couple of hands on the platform. Peter, go ahead. Sorry, Peter, we can't hear you. Maybe we can try to unmute him again. Yeah. There you go. Let's try.
Do you hear me, Rolando?
I do. I do hear.
Okay. Now, this is the last day that Francois Subiga is going to be working with the UN at press conferences. And I just wanted to pay tribute to him on behalf of a lot of journalists who've received help from him in doing radio reports and sending out other reports from the UN. And he will be sorely missed by all the journalists. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Indeed, Monday is actually his last day, but thank you very much for raising it here. Indeed, I would echo those sentiments. Francois has been with the UN for quite a while now, working with the Information Service, and he's been an invaluable team member, and we're going to miss him, of course. He's been providing a very vital service to you, which we'll try to continue in his absence. So we just want to applaud all the hard work and dedication that Francois Subige has been given to you correspondents and, of course, us at the Information Service. So thank you, Francois. John Zarakostas.
Yeah, I'd like to agree with Peter and thank Francois' service to us for more than two decades, and also his invaluable technical support to many of us that are not technically gifted like he is. But I've got two questions. One is, do we know if the UNOG Director General will be applying for a second term for the post and when that decision will be made by the Secretary General in New York. And secondly, at UNHCR, have the applications started for the successor to Mr. Grundy, who steps down at the end of next year? And will they be posting the applicants and their CVs as they come in? Thank you.
Thanks. On the first question, I will have to get back to you on the UN Director General Tatiana Valavaya's intentions for his second term. I'll certainly get back to you on that. But let me just check here, because our UNHCR colleagues have left the room, but I'm not sure if there's anyone online who can address that, but perhaps better if you reach out to them directly with that question on Mr. Grandi's successor. Or on the terms for that position. So, yeah, no one's online, I'm afraid. So if you can reach out to them. On that note, I bid you a nice weekend, bon appétit, and see you here in this room on Tuesday. But beforehand, of course, with Mr. Lazzarini on Monday. Thank you.